Is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. Learn about Krannert Center's 2004-2005 performance season with guest artists Don Upshaw and Richard Good, the English Concert and violinist Andrew Manzi, and the Mark Morris Dance Group by visiting KrannertCenter.com or stopping by to pick up a season brochure. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, with foods from around the world, including imported chocolates, cookies, coffee, extra virgin olive oil, and featuring a selection of new cheeses every week. World Harvest Foods, at the intersection of 6th and University in Champaign, encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. Plague is the greatest killer in history. In the Middle Ages, it killed 40 million people, and in the early 20th century, it moved across Asia, killing 12 million people in India alone. In the final years of the Soviet Union, Soviet scientists created antibiotic-resistant strains of plague for use as biological weapons. On the program today, we'll talk about the disease, its history, and its potential as a weapon with science journalist Wendy Orent. She's the author of Plague, the Mysterious Past and Terrifying Future of the World's Most Dangerous Disease. In the introduction to the book, Orent says on the one hand, plague is, quoting here, a virulent and dangerous disease, but close vigilance and effective treatment make a natural outbreak less likely than at any time in human history. But what about unnatural plague? We now know that the disease became the Soviet military machine's chief bacteriological weapon. It is virulent, transmissible, stable, and able to accept foreign genetic information. Indeed, if plague is ever going to strike again in a massive pandemic, it will probably be a result of deliberate human action, thanks to some of the devastating innovations developed in the Soviet Union and available to many former Soviet scientists. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion. I look forward to your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Wendy Orent has written for many periodicals, including the Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post, the New Republic, and Discover magazine. Her book, Plague, the Mysterious Past and Terrifying Future of the World's Most Dangerous Disease, is published by the Free Press. Again, those telephone numbers, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Wendy Orent, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you.
I think we need to begin with some background, perhaps an overview. Basic questions like, what is plague? Can you tell us about the different types of plague disease, how it is spread, and why it can be so deadly?
Well, it's a very interesting set of questions. The agent of plague, the germ that causes plague, is a bacterium called Yersinia pestis. And all the different manifestations of the disease are caused by this one germ. The most familiar form to us is bubonic plague, with the large swelling in the neck or under the arm or at the groin. It's a large mass of spongy tissue that forms a characteristic swelling called a bubo, and this is one of the chief symptoms that have been remarked throughout the ages that enable by commentators of, you know, in ancient Roman days or in the Middle Ages or in the present, that enable us to recognize this disease as linked as a particular disease, not as a bubo once seen apparently cannot be mistaken for anything else. That is the one form. It kills 60% of those it infects in if they're not treated with antibiotics. And that makes it the least deadly of the three forms of plague. Another form of plague, which kills over 99% of everyone it infects, if they're not treated with antibiotics, is pneumonic plague. This is the same germ, but spread from lung to lung by coughing. Mm-hmm. If the plague germ gets into the lungs, it can be spread on and on and on from person to person through coughing, and this is a very, very deadly form of the disease. The last is septicemic plague, which is plague that is so virulent and intense that it kills within days, even hours. And it does not have time to form the characteristic bubo, and its death rate is close to 100%. Hmm. Bubonic and septicemic plague are spread by fleas.
Okay. Now, in your book, you write, it is a disease that exists quietly beside us, usually unseen and unfelt. Plague may rage through a prairie dog colony in the heart of a Colorado city, leaving hundreds of the animals dead in their burrows, and never touch the jogger who runs through the town or the children who play along its edges. It's only on occasion, as history terribly demonstrates, that it makes the leap from such a reservoir. What do we know? What is known about why plague leaps from its reservoirs? And why is it sometimes so explosive and other times not so explosive?
Well, that has been a matter of tremendous concern, and that was my chief interest in writing this book, which I think of as a kind of detective story. That's the question I wanted to answer. That's the fundamental mystery of plague. Why is it sometimes explosive, and why is it sometimes sluggish? And the answer appears to lie in an entirely different way of looking at plague that we get from Russian scientists. They classify plague according to what they call host strains. A strain in one rodent species, such as prairie dogs, is much less dangerous for people than strains that are found in the high plateaus of Central Asia, where the reservoir are animals called marmots. And for some reason, the marmots give rise to the most virulent form of plague, which is set to go immediately to the lungs, and which, once it gets into humanity, can just burn through a human population. With prairie dogs, the disease was introduced only 100 years ago, and it hasn't become so deadly yet. It kills prairie dogs who haven't evolved any resistance, but it really has a hard time getting into a human being. If somebody were at risk of prairie dog plague, it would be somebody who caught and skinned or handled a sick prairie dog. Prairie dog fleas don't seem to bite people, but if someone actually skinned a prairie dog or had contact with it and the thing bit him or whatever, it's possible that they could get plague. They would then very, very likely die, or if they were treated by antibiotics, they could recover, but they might have a prolonged and horrible convalescence. But it doesn't spread. There's no case on record of prairie dog plague actually moving from person to person.
Mm. Now, fairly early in the book, you introduce us to a couple of people, the chief of the Plague Control Division of the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, Dr. Kenneth Gage, and a Michigan State University researcher, Robert Brubaker. They seem not too concerned about plague. Why not?
Well, I wouldn't say they're not concerned about plague. Nobody in this country knows that plague better than those two scientists, I think. But Dr. Brubaker is more interested in the molecular biology of plague, and he doesn't take the ecologist's view that Dr. Gage does. Dr. Gage is more interested in plague as it exists in the wild among rodents. When I first started talking with him, he was extremely skeptical of the host strain theories and of some of these ideas that I've brought out. But to be perfectly honest, he's changed his mind, which has been very gratifying to me. We've been talking for several years, and he said, well, if you apply evolutionary biology to the study of this disease, this is indeed where you would come out. So he is concerned. He just understands prairie dog plague, really basically the way that I've just presented it, as a sluggish disease and not much of a threat. But I think that he would feel that some of the other strains might be more likely to go to go pneumonic.
Okay. And what are people like? Is Dr. Gage and Professor Brubaker, are these folks and others, are they concerned about the potential of plague as a weapon?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Very definitely. I don't know anyone who studies plague who's not concerned with that.
Yeah.
And I think that the government has paid less attention to plague than they have to anthrax for a couple of peculiar ideas, for a couple of peculiar reasons. One, our scientists who, when we had an offensive program, this was before 1969 when Richard Nixon shut it down, could not successfully grow plague in large quantities without its losing its virulence. There is a trick to this. I don't know what the trick is, but they didn't know either. This was very amusing to the Russian scientists I described this to.
Mm.
But they, because they couldn't grow it in bulk, they really never worked with the agent. They didn't really get very far in weaponizing it, and so it was not a high priority of the U.S. program. Also, in comparison to anthrax, plague is much less durable in the external environment, so they just considered it less of a threat.
Mm.
But I think it's been widely recognized for many years that a cloud of Yersinia pestis disseminated over a city could be a terrible, catastrophic thing.
Hmm. You've mentioned the Russians now a couple of times. Tell us what set you on the trail of this story.
Well, it was my work with Igor Domorodsky. He was one of the principal designers of the Soviet bioweapons program. There was a group called the Interagency Council for on Science and Technology, and they were the organization that actually designed the entire structure of the bioweapons program. This is back beginning in 1973. And Domorodsky was on, he was the deputy chair of this group, and he and his chairman, of Viktor Zhdanov, wanted to bring Russian science into the 20th century by incorporating Western techniques of molecular biology in the service of the biological weapons program. And I first became interested in all of this because I realized that Zhdanov, the great virologist, was also one of the chief architects, in fact, the originator of the idea of eradicating smallpox. And I realized that this might be going on, and I went on his trail, so to speak, and I was able to discover that he was, in fact, that the designer of eradication was also the chief designer of the Soviet bioweapons program, which is something very, very hard to imagine. This man is a cultural hero to anyone involved in the smallpox eradication campaign, and it was horrifying to realize that he was also a designer of bioweapons. But in any case, all of this brought me into contact with Domorodsky. I worked with him. We began to write emails back and forth, and he asked me to help him on his getting his memoir into English. And I did so. I don't know Russian, but we worked together through emails on rewriting his memoir in English. Over time, I began to become interested in plague because that plague was his object of study, and because he was the chief designer of antibiotic-resistant plague. So that is how I became interested in it.
Isn't it interesting that you mentioned the smallpox eradicator,
mm-hmm.
and people who were involved in the Soviet bioweapons program, some of them were also plague fighters.
Yes. Yes, it's very, very hard to understand. I asked Ken Alibek about this once. Ken Alibek is a famous defector who first really broke open the biohazard threat, brought it out into the eyes of the West beginning in 1992. When he first began to be debriefed by our scientists. And I asked him, how is this possible? How could somebody who fought a disease, on the other hand, turn around and make it worse, make it more of a weapon? He said that in Russia, in the Soviet Union, people learned to live on two different levels, that they would be compartmentalized. They'd do their open work, and they would do their closed work, and that somehow the mentality was such that they were able to juggle these two worlds. I really don't know other than that.
Yeah. Well, in the Soviet Union, so many things worked like that. There was the above-ground economy and the black market.
And
you also report in the book that the Soviet Union was destined from the beginning to go down this road.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so very much. According to Domorodsky, the first bioweapons experiments were done before, just at the time that of the Russian Revolution. The very likely dated from all the way back then.
Hmm. Alongside plague, what other biological agents did the Soviets work on?
Well, smallpox was the chief of the virological weapons, that is a weapons caused by viruses. And it remains a terrifying, terrifying biological weapon, especially if you add in vaccine resistance, which there's no proof that they worked on that, but everyone fears that at some point they may have done so. Or some of the other genetic engineering modifications that we know that they did work on, such as adding in certain human immune chemicals, such as an interleukin, to overcome human immunity and make the disease even more deadly. Mm-hmm. They also worked on tularemia. Domorodsky did a lot of work with this. This is also known as rabbit fever. It can be rather deadly, 40% mortality for the hottest strains, but it's not contagious and wasn't nearly as favored a weapon by the Soviets as plague was, because plague, as Domorodsky put it, plague can spread from man to man and no further intervention by the military is necessary. A rather chilling way of putting it.
Yeah. How big, how significant an operation was the Soviet work on bioweapons?
Well, it was enormous. It's been called the Toxic Archipelago. It employed, perhaps at its height, upwards of 30,000 scientists, and it commanded an absolutely massive budget. There were four closed Soviet bioweapons labs run by the military. They're still closed. And then there were the so-called civilian laboratories run by supposedly a civilian branch of the government, but in reality also controlled by the military. These were called the biopreparat labs, and that was also an enormous set of laboratories.
Hmm. What has become of these facilities and their contents?
Well, that's a very good question, and something that I've been particularly interested in tracking. The four Soviet military laboratories are still closed, and we don't know what goes on there. Almost no hints at all. The only thing I've heard recently is that the director of one of these laboratories, Sergei F. Posad, says that he's come up with a cure for Ebola. Why he's working on Ebola, considering that there is no Ebola in the Soviet Union, in Russia, is a question. But that's the only report I've heard of for quite some time coming out of those laboratories. Other than that, they're just a black hole. The other laboratories, Obolensk, which I describe in my book, has fallen on very, very hard times, and some of it is being bought up by industrialists who want to use it to produce various biotechnology products. Vector, the virological laboratory out in Novosibirsk, is continuing to perform research, a lot of it under cooperative work programs with the United States government. I really don't know about most of the rest of the programs. The funding has dropped away, and many of them are simply scraping by or collapsing.
Mm. The industrialists who are interested in these properties, is there any kind of oversight there?
Well, that, too, is a very good question. I don't feel competent to answer that. I think there is some, but that's something that I would very much like to explore, but it's hard to get information on that.
Yeah. What is the level of concern of the international community?
I really couldn't say.
Yeah.
The thing that's disturbing is that not all of these scientists are accounted for. They have the knowledge, but where have they gone?
Mm-hmm.
Don't know. Mm-hmm. It's impossible to say where a lot, some of them are here and working, doing very good work in research programs in America, not closed programs, of course, open kinds of research. Others have scattered to the four winds. I mean, I've heard ghastly stories about people in from the vector laboratories driving as taxi drivers just to support their families. If a government offered them lots of money to come and work on a bioweapons program, would they go? I don't know. I know that our government has successfully stopped some scientists from going to Iran. But again, I don't know more than that.
Yeah. Well, that's something that you report in the book, Plague. You report that Damaratsky turned down a request to talk about the manipulation of plague in Iran.
Yes, he did.
And I imagine he and others have received similar invitations from other countries or other individuals.
Well, I'm certain that they have. Damaratsky said he refused it out of principle.
Yeah.
I don't know if everyone has his principles.
Yeah. And Damaratsky is a man whose principles were compromised in the past. You know, you just kind of wonder.
Well, yes, yes and no. As he puts it, he was a patriot. He thought that the U.S. had a program, and he, in fact, he finds it difficult to believe. He doesn't even believe me when I tell him that we don't. He thinks that there's still a closed program here, which is disturbing, but I don't seem to be able to change his mind about that. But other than that, he thought he was being a patriotic Soviet citizen. Mm. It's hard for us to understand or justify it, and I really don't try.
Right. He told you to scare us.
No, that was Lev Melnikov.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. And
that was a friend of his, yeah.
Yeah. And this is really scary stuff. How concerned should we be?
Well, it's one of these things that is really low risk, high consequence.
Hmm.
In other words, I don't think we're likely to see an attack of antibiotic-resistant plague anytime soon. I don't think it's likely. But I think we have to think about it and be prepared for it anyway, because as Sergei Popov, another one of these former Soviet bioweaponeers, as he said to me, it would be a terrible, terrible thing. A ghastly thing if it really happened, almost unthinkable. So it's something we need to be prepared for, but I don't think, I've never agreed with those people, researchers, scientists, people in this involved in the area of biodefense, who say it's not a question of if we're attacked by biological weapons, it's a question of when. I personally am somewhat more skeptical than that. I think it's a question of if, but I think it's a very horrible if.
How prepared are we?
Oh, I don't think we're prepared at all.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote an article for the LA Times, it's coming out this Sunday, about the issue of quarantine. We have no national biodefense policy. People think we do, but we don't. We have no system, a federal system of quarantine. Quarantine is the only way that you can fight antibiotic-resistant plague. Nothing else will work unless you happen to find the right antibiotic, and that would be a long process if they've made it resistant, as Ali Beck says, to 10 different antibiotics. Finding the right one would be a very difficult thing to do.
Mm.
But so quarantine is our best weapon. It doesn't cure anybody, but it prevents the disease from spreading. So we need some regulations that would keep, that would allow the government to put people in quarantine.
Yeah. That brings us to the history of plague, and that is something that you write about in Plague, the book, The Mysterious Past and Terrifying Future of the World's Most Dangerous Disease. When did quarantine come to be used, to be understood as a way to control plague?
Well, I think they used it even in the Middle Ages, but it became very widely used later on in the Renaissance. But it was implemented in really, truly terrifying and horrible ways. In London, if you had the plague, or anyone thought you had the plague, and they certainly didn't have doctors going around making these diagnoses. They left it to old women and people drawn from the lowest level of society who would go around and look at people and say, ah, he's got the plague. And then they would nail the whole family up together in a house. If they did have the plague, then everyone would die. So quarantine has a hideous reputation, quite well deserved. But in the case of London, it wouldn't have even done anything to prevent the spread of the disease, since that disease, unlike the Black Death, was largely rat and rat flea-borne.
What is the first report of plague in history?
The very first report that we know of for certain, or I say for certain, as near as certain as anything like this can be, would probably be Rufus of Ephesus, and that is sometime before Christ. And also there is a mention in the Bible that looks very suspicious. It's the section about mice and fleas in Ashdod. Let me see. The hand of the Lord lay heavy upon the Ashdodites, and he wrought havoc among them. He struck Ashdod and its territory with hemorrhoids. And it goes on and on about this plague of hemorrhoids, which if you actually look at the Hebrew, it doesn't say, it says ophalim, which means swellings, not hemorrhoids at all, swellings in the groin. It very likely was, so that is a mistranslation, hemorrhoids, it very likely was an outbreak of plague. But again, with a report like this, it's very, very tenuous. Yeah.
So those could have been buboes?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Yeah.
They must have been buboes.
Yeah, yeah.
Or very likely were buboes, yes. And there's also a curious mention of the mice that ravage your fields, which indicates that there were a lot of, the word for mice and rats in Hebrew is the same. It's achbar, and so the achbarim would have been mice or rats. Rats in the fields, people with buboes, sounds like plague to me.
Yeah.
The first one we really know of for sure would have been the Justinian plague in that's 542 A.D.
Yeah. Tell us about the Justinian plague.
Well, that was a huge and horrifying outbreak, not on the scale of the Black Death, but still very, very devastating. Justinian was the emperor at Constantinople of the Roman Empire, but of course the seat was in Constantinople at the time. He was very anxious to rebuild the Roman Empire that had so fallen off in the years before he ascended to the throne, and so he had these various wars in different parts of the empire to try to reconnect the empire again. And he took over North Africa and began huge shipments of grain from Alexandria and other Egyptian cities to Constantinople and elsewhere in the circum-Mediterranean area. And these grain shipments, because North Africa was at that point the breadbasket of the entire empire, these grain shipments were filled with rats and rat fleas. And the what I did in the book is show how the footprint of the plague follows the trade routes, and that it seems to have been an area of plague that, though very devastating, stuck very closely to the coastal areas, and wherever there was a trade route, that's where you would get a big outbreak of plague. It didn't penetrate far inland. But it still was very devastating. We don't know how many people died, but it could have been in the hundreds of thousands in Constantinople alone, and quite a number of million in the entire Roman Empire.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is science journalist Wendy Arendt. She is the author of Plague, the Mysterious Past and Terrifying Future of the World's Most Dangerous Disease. You can join us, listeners, with your questions and comments this afternoon. Phone lines are open. Here are the numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, from the Justinian plague, we move to the Black Death. Truly, if the Justinian plague was horrific, the Black Death, can you say even more so?
Oh, infinitely worse.
Yeah.
Infinitely worse. Because it was a different form of plague. What I am suggesting in this book is that the Justinian plague, which was known to have originated in Central Asia, was almost certainly a strain of plague from this ancient reservoir I described earlier among the marmots of Central Asia, the ancient, the oldest and the most virulent form of plague in the world. When plague gets into a human population from marmots, as it did in Central Asia, we found graves have been found from dating, I think, to 1338 that say that the people in the cemetery died of plague. These earliest cases apparently came in from someone hunting a marmot, as the people of the region have done from time immemorial and as they continue to do today. The plague got in and then was propelled along the trade routes established by the Mongols of the time. I like to blame Justinian for the Justinian plague, since he created the conditions that allowed it to happen. And I also I blame Genghis Khan mm-hmm. for the Black Death, because even though he was 150 years earlier, the trade routes stopped being just the Silk Road, this thin thread of caravans that moved across from Europe to Asia, but instead became a great, what you could think of as a great road of men. And Mongols could travel unbelievably quickly and rapidly and effectively, and they spread the disease. And that's been tracked out very beautifully by a historian named Michael Doles, who shows in his book, The Black Death in the Middle Ages, in the Middle East, exactly how the disease was able to spread. And it spread like wildfire because it was carried by human beings and because it was this intensely, intensely virulent strain. Mm.
Let's talk with a listener now, a caller on a cell phone, line one. Go ahead. Caller on line one.
Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
I recently read the book Year of Wonders by Geraldine Brooks about the plague in 1665 in this small village. I think it's pronounced Ames.
Yeah, yes.
Can you tell us about that, how accurate that is, or are you familiar with the book?
Well, I didn't read the book. I'm sorry. So I really can't say how accurate it was.
It was so enjoyable, and the people in the village seemed to be so were led by someone, but so brave to isolate themselves.
Well, that actually did happen. The rector of Eon insisted that they wall themselves off from neighboring villages. That part is absolutely true. And everyone died, but he didn't die, but his wife did, and I think he had sent his children away. But most people in the village did die of plague after that year of being locked up with it.
Oh, I really recommend the book for anybody who's interested in, of course, it was fictional characters in it also, but it opened my eyes to plague.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Next, we're going to talk with a listener on the toll-free line in Washington, Illinois, line 4. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
One of the things that strikes me about all this is that defense against bioterrorism and against bioweapons right now seems to be sort of a small sideshow, and it looks to me somewhat unlikely to ever get the money it needs. But one thing that I could see that would perhaps do something good for all of humanity and also get it the money it needs would be, instead of attacking bioweapons, why not a coordinated effort to destroy infectious organisms that attack people? That is, launch a really big international effort to wipe out diseases, natural and man-made, and the ways that they can spread.
Well, are you calling for a large public health campaign then?
No, not large public health. Large research and development campaign so that we can develop weapons against bacteria, viruses, fungus, and perhaps even yeast, so that to essentially bring to an end the era in which bacteria and viruses and other microorganisms can attack human beings. It seems to me that the history of the last 50 years is we put a lot of effort into antibiotics. They got good enough, and now we're at a point where there are relatively few infectious diseases that attack people in the countries that can afford to pay for drug development. So the basic thing is that organism-borne disease is pretty much a sideshow, and it's the chronic diseases of old age that where all the money is going. Also, there's a concept that there's a concept in terms of biomedical funding that we spend X number of dollars based on what gets appropriate for the NIH or some percentage of what drug companies make as profit or something like this. And I'm saying instead, look at bioterrorism as part of a larger human problem of disease and say it's worth putting worldwide $50 to $100 billion a year over a period of perhaps 10, 15, 20 years into attacking disease organisms, researching how they work, and treat it as this is one form of weapons of mass destruction that we can really get our hands on and wipe out as a threat to humanity.
Well, unfortunately, you can't really eliminate diseases from a reservoir. There's absolutely no way to eliminate plague. You could eliminate smallpox because its only reservoir was human.
Let me rephrase. I don't mean eliminate from the reservoir. I mean have enough antimicrobial agents and have enough backup antimicrobial agents and have enough understanding of how microbes infect humans that creating bioweapons would be seen as being about as futile as anti-missile missiles of the collision sort. I mean, it's like everybody sees, hey, it just ain't going to work. You build a bioagent, there's defense in depth against it. Put your money into nerve gas or H-bombs. I'm saying make it so that the defense ministries can't see bioweapons as a workable agent.
Right, simply because you would attack... You would develop a better arsenal of antibiotics and antivirals.
Antibiotics, antivirals, and also understanding of how we can quickly synthesize new ones, how we can look at how something has become resistant and immediately counter the resistance.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically defense in depth. Now, I don't know whether long-term you could do that without also creating the ability to create very excellent bioweapons, but I think it would be worth a shot, and at least it would have the side effect of eliminating natural death by disease organisms.
Well, I think that would be a goal we would all be happy about.
And I guess my question is, has anyone been thinking about this as opposed to trying to track movement of scientists who know about it? I mean, it seems like up until now, people haven't really thought of this as something worth doing. I mean, it's kind of like the atom bomb before the neutron discovery in 1939. Everybody knows, well, maybe someday we can do it, but there's no sense of urgency because they don't think it can be done.
Well, I think that scientists are working on a lot of different ways of treating diseases that are very novel and potentially very powerful. But, for example, treating Ebola with an agent derived from nematodes that seems to stop the coagulation cascade, that is the massive bleeding that happens in Ebola patients, and they've achieved some success with that. But finding ways, you see, disease germs are evolved organisms, and they're very, very, very good at what they do. They have learned over the millions of years to subvert mammalian immune systems. There is no easy way to counteract that. It has to be done on a case-by-case basis, a disease-by-disease basis. And some of these diseases are really very intractable. I mean, people still die of plague. I had a friend who got infected with plague as a medical student, and within hours he was hooked up to IV lines, and he still almost died.
Mm.
So it's, I don't think we will ever see cures for all infectious diseases, but that doesn't mean that people aren't doing aggressive and interesting things.
This point about bacteria and viruses being able to evolve, that's why the Central Asia repository is so so virulent.
Exactly.
The marmots, these woodchuck-like animals, they're
rodents. Yeah, they look like giant, very ugly woodchucks.
Yeah.
Or like giant prairie dogs.
And they've been... And this bacteria, the plague germ, has been there in Central Asia for a long, long time.
Thousands of years.
Yeah. And there is where it is most
virulent.
Yeah.
But the thing is, as the marmot, the different species, as the marmots evolve resistance, the bacteria becomes more virulent and better at killing, and then the marmots evolve more resistance. Because you can see how natural selection will play a big role in this. Everyone who's not resistant is going to die. If you have resistance, you're more likely to survive, and you pass on your resistance genes. And conversely, the disease that's best at exploiting host tissues is going to remain active, and the less virulent or less transmissible diseases will strains will disappear. So it's a constant arms race between the reservoir and the bug. And the interesting thing about marmots, and the reason that they seem to be so deadly for people, is that marmots are the only animals outside human beings that can contract pneumonic plague. So that when a pneumonic strain from the marmots gets into human beings, it's kick-started to spread. And that's what I'm arguing happened in the Black Death.
Yeah, yeah.
And it happened again in Manchuria several times in the last century.
Yeah. I have a couple of questions left, and we're going to have to wrap up pretty quickly here. The Japanese in World War II dropped bombs containing plague over China.
Yes.
What happened?
People died.
Yeah.
No one knows how many, but it seems to have been in the thousands. What they did is they took the so-called human flea, Pulex irritans, and they exposed them to plague, and then the Pulex fleas were let loose in these porcelain bombs that they invented, and they attacked people, and people died. And Domorodsky was shown where these bombs were dropped by his Chinese hosts when he went to visit the area.
Has plague been used as a biological weapon elsewhere in history?
Well, we always hear about Kaffa, how the Tartars supposedly took their dead bodies and hurtled them over the walls into the city of the fortress of Kaffa, which was controlled by the Genoese at the time. There is absolutely no evidence this actually occurred. It may have. It's talked about a lot as if it did occur, but in fact, we only have one report of that happening, and it was not from an eyewitness. There's another report from Kaffa that says tells a completely different story. Impossible to say. It might have, it might not have, but that's the only other explanation, the only other case that I know of.
Yeah. How likely or unlikely would it be for terrorists to get their hands on plague and use it?
They would have to get the Soviet strains. If they tried to dig it out of the ground from an infected groundhog or prairie dog, they wouldn't get very far. First of all, it would kill them. And second of all, there is no really good vaccine, so there's no way that they could protect themselves. So they'd end up dead. And second of all, if they managed somehow to survive that, they would end up with a very poor biological weapon. And even if you went and found a sick marmot, which would be quite a trick, some of the Manchurian scientists, the scientists during the Manchurian epidemic tried to do it and failed. It took a long, long time. Even if you managed to find a sick marmot, you would only be, maybe you'd get 50% that you would get a strain that would be worth making into a weapon, because not all the marmot strains are that virulent either. There's a range of variants in any disease. The real fear is not somebody getting it out of nature, but getting it from the former Soviet biological weapons program. That's what would worry me.
Yeah. There we have to leave it. Wendy, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you very much.
Wendy Arendt has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She is the author of Plague, The Mysterious Past and Terrifying Future of the World's Most Dangerous Disease. The book is published by the Free Press. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. From the Board of Trade this afternoon, futures in the bean pit bouncing back nicely today after a couple, 3 or 4 days of hard turnarounds on the downside. They did finish in the nearby Julys for the day at 907.5, and that was 33.5 cents higher. So they managed to climb above that $9 level. Probably will be important to talk to our analysts this afternoon when we talk to Mr. Cooley at 6 after the hour, 2 o'clock today, about that in the marketplace during the closing market report. Let's take a look, really, at what happened at the Chicago Board of Trade across those grains floors. July futures in the wheat pit, 377 was the settlement price. They were up 6.5 on the day. The high was 379, a low at 372.5, and a settlement price, once again, in the July wheat at 377. They were up 6.5 cents for the day. September futures, 385.5, the high, the low at 379.5. They settled 384, up 6.5 in December contract. 395, the high, the low at 389. The settlement there, 394, up 7.5 for the day. May contract, 401, the high, the low at 395. Settled $4.25, climbing up above $4 at 7.25 higher for the day. May futures in the wheat pit, 395, the high, the low in the settlement. Obviously didn't trade for the day or just traded once, up 7 cents for the day. Must have traded once for the day. July futures, 298.75, the high, the low at 293.25. Settlement price at 298.5, up 6.5 for the day. In September, 293 in the corn pit, the high, a low at 287.5, settled 292.75, up 6.5. December futures, 290, the high, the low at 284.5, and a settlement price at 289.75, up 6.5. The March futures, 294.25, high, low at 288.5. They settled 294.25, up 6.5 cents for the day. May futures for the corn pit, 298, the high, low at 292.25, settled 298, up 7.25. In July 2005, 297.25, high, low at 291.25. They settled 296.75. They were up 7.25 on the day. September futures, 280 high, low at 279. Settled 279.75, up 1.75. And the December contract in the corn pit, 270 the high, low at 268.5. Settlement price there at 269.5. They're a penny and a half higher for the day. July oats now 151.5 high, low at 146. Settled 150 even, up 3.5 cents. September futures 156.5 high, low at 153. Settled 155.5. And they were a penny off their high for the day, up 3 cents. From the soy complex, the nearby July beans, 9.13 the high, low at 8.79, climbing back through that $9 level today, settle at 9.07.5. They were up 33.5 cents. August soybeans up 22.5, a high of 8.55, a low at 8.28, settled at 8.49.5. September contract, 7.65.5 high, low at 7.42, settled 7.59. Up 18.5 cents for the day. November beans, that's your harvest month, an important settlement here too. 7.10 the high, the low at 6.92. They managed above to settle above $7 at 7.07, even up 11.25. January soybeans 7.11 the high, the low at 6.93, settled 7.07 in those Jans. They were up a dime for the day. The March futures 7.05 the high, the low at 6.95. Settled $7.05, 6 cents higher, and the May futures were up a dime for 2005. They had a high today of 6.98, a low at 6.85, and a settlement price at 6.96. From the bean meal pit, July futures 2.96, the high, the low at 2.84.50, settled 2.94.20. They were up 11.70. August futures at 280.30, the high, the low at 272, settled 279.20, and they were up 9.10 for the day. July bean oil, 29.90 on the high, the low at 29.20, settled 29.75, up 79, and the August bean oil, and 29.15 for the high, the low at 28.50, they settled 29.07, and they finished the day 72 higher. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. Celeste?
Thank you, Todd. A mostly higher day today on the Mercantile Exchange for livestock. May feeder cattle, the high today 104.25, the low 103.25, the settlement 104.17.5, that up 85. August 103.07.5, today's high, the low 101.50, the settlement 102.92.5, that up 147.5. September feeder cattle 101.50, the high, 99.95, the low, 101.45, the settlement, that was up 145. June live cattle, 82.90 the high, 81.45 the low, 82.85 the settlement, that up 130. August live cattle, 85.15 the high, 83.65 the low, 85.12.5 the settlement, that up 137.5. June lean hogs, today's high, 75.20, the low, 74.52.5, the settlement, 75.05, that down 27.5. July, 74.90 the high, 73.60 the low, 74.80 the settlement, that up 85. August lean hog, 73.90 the high, 71.70 the low, 73.70 the settlement, that up 152.5. October lean hog, 61.90 the high, 60.50 the low, 61.80 the settlement, that up 90. And May pork bellies down the limit today, 119.02.5 the high, and that's the number across the screen. So I think that opened a limit down today. That's a look at settlement prices from the Mercantile Exchange. On Wall Street, the Dow is currently up 41 points at 10,009. The NASDAQ is up 19 points at 1917. And the S&P 500 is up 5 points at 1096.
Agricultural information is made possible in part by a grant from the Archer Daniels Midland Company. ADM, the nature of what's to come.
This is Les Schulte, WILL's Director of Corporate Support. If you own or manage an agribusiness, you can help in supporting this valuable service on AM 580. To find out more information, give us a call at 217-333-0850.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Beringer, or Beringer, I suppose, from St. Clair Shores, Michigan, writes, Dear Dr. Science, what is the opposite of delusions of grandeur?
Chronic feelings of shame and guilt. I know it's hard to believe, but I felt that way for most of my life. Then I discovered magnesium chromate, the salt that makes food taste better and life worth living. Having trouble sleeping? Just guzzle a quart of magnesium chromate solution and you'll be out of commission for a week. But that's not all. I'm not sure when the realization hit me, but one day I came to believe that I'm not responsible for starting World War II. My indifference had nothing to do with the rise or fall of international communism. Thanks to magnesium chromate, the only delusions I suffer from are that not all my problems can be solved by taking this miracle supplement. The next voice you hear will tell you how to order.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Doc's Breath and distributed by PRI. To order the Dr. Science Get Smart Kit with CD and Master's Degree Mousepad $21.95, call 800-989-DUCK.
It's 1 minute before 2 o'clock. You're tuned to AM 580 WILL